Welcome, everyone, to Commerce Experience. I'm your host, Brian Walker, Chief Strategy Officer at Bloomreach. My guest today is best described as a powerhouse in the world of digital commerce, Sergey Ostapenko, CEO of digital commerce services agency, Mira Commerce. Sergey is an experienced entrepreneur and executive and a hands-on strategic leader. His work and leadership have influenced some of the world's best-known businesses, agencies, and brands. Before starting Mira, Sergey led Valtech's North American e-commerce practice and is a regular speaker at e-commerce industry events in Europe and North America. And he even trains and coaches sales and delivery teams at major global IT organizations. Sergey has also founded Mira Action, a California-based nonprofit that buys and delivers ambulances, medicines, and humanitarian supplies to Ukrainian hospitals and the front line. Sergey has personally delivered many of these ambulances himself, deep inside Ukraine over the last year, and we'll discuss his own personal experience with the war in this episode as well. Enjoy the show. Sergey, thank you so much for taking the time to join us here on the podcast today. I really appreciate it.
Welcome, Brian. Good to talk to you.
Sergey, we always start with the same question when we have a guest on the podcast. What was your first role or job that dealt with digital or e-commerce?
Oh, geez. I think this was in the year 2006 or 2007 when I was the CFO and I ran the operations and as the interim manager for Avon Cosmetics in Ukraine. And we were working on the website of the company. And I first had to deal with the shopping cart and the way that they want to track their history of orders and things like that. So back in that time, there was not much choice. It were all monolithic, huge Java-based software platforms. And so you had to go global, invest millions and millions of dollars into each initiative.
Which platform was Avon using at the time?
I believe it was something along the lines of SAP Sitecore, but I wouldn't remember exactly today. So there's been a whole stack of technologies there across different regions.
So Sergey, you have a tremendous amount of experience with digital transformation, starting way back then. And of course, now you advise and consult with many different kinds of organizations, and you've been involved in lots of different kinds of programs. And I know that you are someone who's really good at working with leaders to help them prepare themselves and their organizations for that. And I'm interested in, like, just say the three things that you think are most important for leaders inside organizations to understand and think about before they begin a transformation program.
Very interesting question. And I think the question relates more to people side of business than technology side of business. I think it's, first of all, the mindset of the leader who is embarking on this journey to get early buy-in from his peers who are running the business alongside with him or her. So they may be in the IT department, they may be in the marketing department, e-com department, VP of digital transformation, initiating this stuff inside the organization. So I think the buy-in from the peers is very important to consider this as a strategic initiative that is going to create value as a profit center as opposed to the cost center for the company. So it's not about implementing a new shiny tool or a new way to connect systems. It's actually about rethinking business from the ground up. So that buy-in is very important. I think another one is people should realize that change takes time. And as much as they talk about change management and setting realistic expectations, you should always plan for something at X and then multiply that by two or a factor of 2.5 of the amount of time it's going to take to implement those change initiatives. So be ready, be patient, and also be conscious of the fact that it takes time for people to adjust, and not just because of the politics or their own personal agendas. And then the third one, I think it really is important to get to know the technical aspects of where technology is moving in commerce, in digital platforms today, and be on the forefront of things, not just reading the shallow marketing papers out there with a lot of buzzwords, but actually getting your hands on the technology and having somebody on your team who understands. I call it the brain trust. So trusting somebody who is actually hands-on on a specific thing and involving them in the conversation early on to understand the specifics of what's good and bad about specific technology.
So this is kind of a big question because I know someone with your experience, I know that the way I think about it, there's a range of different things that can go wrong. Mm-hmm. But often those things are rooted in some pretty common problems. And I'm interested in what you see as sort of the typical things that people don't anticipate for some reason that go wrong. Even people with a lot of experience sometimes miss. I'm interested in what do you see as it typically goes wrong and how you can try to mitigate that.
Statistics show that most projects fail because of the lack of communication. And I think the upfront communication with the platforms, with the software product companies, as well as agencies and integrators that implement them, need to be taken to a different level. I hate the process of RFPs, requests for proposals.
Yeah, me too.
This process basically dehumanizes the interaction and the conversation initially. Yep. And you just cannot compare apples to apples across different platforms, compare features. It's only indicative of what you're about to experience when you go into the project with both software vendor as well as the solution provider or the service company. I have had companies that did extensive multi-month engagements building those RFPs and figuring out the feature parity, breaking the platforms at the atomic level. And then those projects fail because they failed to consider the most important thing. Who are the people that are going to be actually supporting you from that platform? And who are the people who are going to be implementing that platform for you? The most successful clients of mine that implemented on time, on budget, on scope, and were satisfied and they were promoted internally after doing this great job are people who are always interviewing the actual doers. Again, back to my original mm-hmm. point of having the brain trust. Who is that brain inside your meetings as you select your future vendor who actually knows the platform in and out and who can speak more towards your specific needs and who can demonstrate that they understand your business and learned enough to actually contribute and create value there? So I think it's important to have those conversations and interviews up front. Yeah, list of features by platform, comparing the different platforms together, you know, looking at the credentials of an experience level of an agency is important. But I think that you got to get everybody in the same room as a future client and actually see people interaction together. If you have multiple vendors in the room, a shopping cart, a search, intelligence search platform, a CDP, a CMS, you know, CMS group of people, then you have the integrator that has experience combining them together. You need to have that joint demo, and you need to see the level of alignment between these different partners, how they're going to work together to deliver your solution. And that's the step that cannot be underestimated. And sometimes agencies will tell you that, oh, well, we don't know who exactly is going to work on your site until we actually get going. Yeah, that's true. But show me at least the caliber of your people, your smart thinkers, who are going to be addressing some of my challenges that solve similar problems. And let's connect them one-to-one to my team who is very technical and let them talk to each other. And then you observe the interactions and it becomes incredibly visible what the level of depth is and the level of focus on you as a customer as opposed to just pushing another shiny tool so that they can get the logo.
I was in the UK last week and I met with a number of our very senior, very experienced clients who are doing multi-million dollars on the platform. They're in many ways the clients we would point to as doing exceptionally well in their industries and obviously great examples of using our solution. Right. What was kind of interesting though, many of them talked about the people that they're interacting with at our organization and partners as being really, really, really important to them. And what's also interesting, they're using a fraction of the platform's capabilities. Okay. The reason why I say that is, in the process of selecting the platforms, I'm sure they went through a very rigorous RFP process. I'm sure they made sure that all the features, all the things, right? And maybe we were fortunate to be picked through that process, but at the end of the day, that's actually not where the value is coming from, right? It's to your point. It's making sure the important things are there and that they have the support they need to be successful. And they may, over time, can layer in these additional capabilities that are hopefully going to be used effectively. But today, their organizations aren't ready for that. So it's kind of ironic. A lot of software is picked through these rigorous, like, as you said, sort of dehumanizing process, right? Ultimately, a solution is picked often because it's the most feature rich, even though that organization can't actually use that capability probably for some time. And if they haven't put all the other pieces together, they're putting themselves behind an eight ball, in my opinion.
And in addition to that, also, I've seen a number of companies with a great product, but the product that was not supported well by the organization, and vice versa. The product was very basic, a sort of an MVP initial prototype that was supported by the great team with the focus on customer that had a great roadmap and a lot of talent internally to make it work. And I've seen both cases, both examples. And, you know, you always fail because of the human factor. Mm-hmm. You may win if the product is good, if the product is better, but you will definitely fail if that product is not supported well. And so there are indirect ways to find that out. I always tell my customers to go read some the developer forums about, that have exchanges, live exchanges of people who actually are experiencing and going through the implementation. And you would hear comments like, oh, this solution is held by duct tape and prayers. And why couldn't they get that out and out of the door already for 3 years and we have to fix that manually? Or things like Glassdoor reviews and Indeed reviews.
Yeah.
You go in there and you look at the turnover inside the organization and you understand that the climate is not that healthy. And so what are you going to have three project managers and two technical leads change over the course of the project implementation? No, that's not going to be healthy for you in any case. Right. And so those things need to be brought into the conversations and the conversation has to be very candid. Can you or can you not deliver this product to me based on my unique needs and prove it to me and earn my trust, earn your ability to prescribe anything to me before copying and pasting your solution onto me. So that's the motto.
Switching topics a little bit, I want to talk about composable commerce. And I'd like to begin by asking you to help us with the definition of composable commerce. How would you define it?
I'll do it maybe by an analogy.
Yeah.
Imagine that you're coming into the concert and you are expecting a great performance, but they tell you that instead of buying a single ticket, you now need to pay the drummer and the pianist and the singer separately, and you have to organize their Uber and have them arrive to the venue at the same time. And you also need to run them their practice before they actually play in front of you. Okay? Well, that's not composable. So that is like a fragmented way in which many of these solutions have been built in the past few years when people jumped on this train of, hey, let's select the best of breed components and let's start to optimize the e-commerce solutions by getting out of the suite world, the monolithic legacy world, into these composable, highly fragmented, headless solutions, building custom storefronts to optimize them for the technical performance and Google indexation and whatnot. To me, composable is the approach to building your commerce solution where each building block comes from the best of breed components and tools and platforms and services where they all work towards achieving your goal. And that is growing the traffic on the site, improving conversions, improving Google visibility. And the channel has to work for you. To build that channel, you cannot rely on any single provider, any single platform anymore. And that's basics, right? People have been talking about this for many, many years now that, okay, the monolith that claims that they do it all cannot do it all. There needs to be a focus. And so composable commerce is the way to combine those things in the most effective way that will work for you. Now, the question is, who is the conductor? And how do you build the world in which you buy the ticket to the performance and you arrive there and the whole orchestra plays in front of you? But we can dig deeper into that because there are different roles and different areas of responsibility there.
It's a really interesting analogy because I think you have to be able to pull these things together in a seamless, effective way in order to get the business value that you're seeking, or else you could end up in a different kind of challenge to run and manage your digital commerce and digital experience and marketing. How do you talk to business leaders about the business value of the composable approach? Because it is a little esoteric when you're taking really a technology architecture and paradigm and framework, and then you're trying to talk about the business opportunities associated with that. And often they come across as kind of platitudes, and they may come across as somewhat theoretical or somewhat downstream, like, oh, endless touch points and all these different emerging experiences that you'll be able to power. But many business leaders are like, that's a little far out in the future for my practical needs. But obviously there is a business value there, and I often am speaking about that too, but I'm interested in how you talk about that with business leaders that you're engaging with?
So the topic is almost in every conversation today with merchants who are considering the next step, the next level up. What do you think about composable? Is headless the right solution for us? We hear that there is a lot of effort and we need to have technical teams ready to embrace that and ready to support that. And that is much more costly to implement those types of solutions. So there are different aspects of it. What are the components of value that you create? Those are very distinct things in e-commerce. You grow sales, you reduce the costs, you mitigate risks, and you grow your organization market share. Those are the four components where we implement those that we implement those sites for. So we indirectly impact them by driving conversions, by driving traffic to the site. But at the end of the day, it's these four. Okay, so how can you realize that value? How can you have the time to value shortened through composable? Well, first of all, composable allows you to get better results out of the different components of your solution. So I'll give you one example. If you implement a content management system today that is better suited for business users, that provides marketers with the new and more intuitive, simpler to use tools to manage content, to schedule content publication, to actually have the pipeline and the workflow of approving this content and managing multimedia assets easier, that's reducing your costs. That's like making their lives easier. They deserve just as much attention as those shoppers who are converting on your site from visitors. But that would be one example. So if you know of a tool, if you're considering a tool that is going to ease the lives of marketers and you want to embed this as part of your future solution and you know that that's the way to go, well, that's part one part of the composable piece that you already figured out. Let's freeze that for a moment and then talk about the shopping cart. Okay, so what's the best of breed, best performing shopping cart out there that doesn't claim to be the next Amazon and that doesn't make a lot of money from fulfillment and payment?
We're not going to name names. We're not going to name names. Yeah.
Let's talk about something that allows you to present the products in the best way, add the products to cart, actually compare them to other products, add them to cart, check out in a very optimized, simple way. Well, that's another piece that you just figured out. Can you combine those two things together? Well, this is where we're talking about this fragmentation. The problem today in time to value is not in selecting the right components. The right components are out there, and there are many very credible, strong, solid niche players that will fill those needs. The problem is orchestration, okay? The way that you orchestrate today is very, very disorganized. You have to go through all these demos of different vendors. Mm-hmm. You have to figure out internally, well, how am I going to feed the data from this system to that system? And then you have an agency, a consultant, like my company, for example, that's in there and that says, well, we can build out of that. And we can, this is the solution architecture that we can create for you. And the customer says, well, wait, we're not ready yet. Because we need to still figure out if that or that solution is a good fit for us. We need to negotiate pricing, get the sandboxes going, right? And then that becomes very difficult to manage and to time right. Okay, so in so many words, I'm telling you that the path to value today is blocked by this fragmentation and by the lack of agencies who are, by the lack of agency high-end quality consulting work acting as that conductor. Agencies at large today either specialize in the marketing aspects of things, doing digital marketing, ad campaigns, and running the channels, or they're systems integrators, technologists at heart, that really pay more attention to implementing specific solutions that they're certified and experienced in, right? And very few advisors out there who can understand the business A to Z and understand what is the meaning of that composable solution for the client, if there is a value, right? So that's how we start the conversation. So let us be that company that would help you not only select the best of breed, but also facilitate that conversation between them and build that map of how these pieces are going to work together to reduce that time to value. And then, of course, there are derivatives out of that. You know, the site is going to be faster, better performing in Google. You're going to get the better indexation, better visibility, those core web vital factors that indirectly indicate the usability of your site to Google. Those things are going to impact performance way more than your creative assets. But before you talk about the technical metrics, you have to really get the merchant into that mindset, the client into that mindset of, okay, how do these pieces work together and how can I actually streamline that time to value.
And I think I also don't want to underestimate the impact of working with an agency that has a set of solutions that they're very familiar with. I say agency, but as you said, it's often a systems integrator in the commerce and sort of experience context. And they have a set of solutions that they have done before, that they have training on. When they say they've done it before, it also means they've made mistakes before. They know what mistakes to avoid. They know how to put these things together. They have the relationships with the software vendors, if needed, right, to help solve challenges. You're mitigating a huge amount of wasted energy and money from trying to do it yourself, making all those mistakes yourself. You're working with somebody who has a track record. They've also, in a sense, already curated a set of solutions, often based on your business application, your business, your vertical, you know, the channels that you're working with, what's important to you. And if you're choosing the partner well, you're really thoughtful about that. And again, relationships are really, really important because things do go wrong, right? And if they know, for example, you personally in that process, and they're like, I always know that I can call the man in charge or the woman in charge, and I can make sure that the things that need to happen can happen. And then that trickles down into the software space as well. Yes, once you're live, you're more than likely working directly with the software vendor. So all those same things apply. But the role of the integrator and agency in this composable era is more important, in my opinion, than it was before. Although it's always been important. I think it's even more important now.
I think the market is going to swing back to the more traditional roles of service providers in our space that are more of the ISVs and VAR value-add resellers, where you do need to have one producer of your concert performance. You do need somebody who you're going to write the check out to and whose SLAs are going to be there for you, and who's going to be on the line for support, and who's going to work with the software vendors in the back end, being a distributor, reseller, whatever the relationship is. So I'm curious to see if that trend actually picks up and there will be your point of contact as a solution provider, you know?
Yeah. And if the cellist isn't cutting it, well, guess what? The orchestra director has to find the way to find the better cellist, right? Not to pick on cellists, but...
But you can never blame the customer, right? If the customer prefers to go to another concert, or if they like jazz more than classic music, well, you know, we need to build a different orchestra.
I'm going to be down the street in the punk show, just to let you know.
We're on the edge of something big, the future of AI-powered e-commerce. Join us this August along with fellow industry leaders in digital commerce and AI for live conversations about what e-commerce can achieve in a symbiotic future with AI. We'll talk about how AI fits into your business today, tomorrow, and for the limitless future ahead. In short, 2 days of thought-provoking conversation, perspective-shifting keynotes and sessions, and endless opportunities for growth. Connect with Bloomreach on your favorite social channel to learn more and watch live.
I'm going to switch topics, Sergey, and I want to talk about something that I know is incredibly important to you, and I think it should be important to everyone, and that is the war that's happening right now in the Ukraine. And I've got a kind of a four-part question for you, so I'm just going to give you the first part. I know we're well over a year into the Russian invasion of Ukraine, and of course, the war began much before then. But we're about a year into this chapter, I guess you'd say, of the war. If you could kind of recount for our listeners the impact that that had and what that was like for you, your family, your community, and your company, and recount that experience and that time right after things really kicked off.
Yeah, Brian. I'm an American Ukrainian. So I was born in Ukraine. I lived there for most of my adult life, and I traveled internationally, and I settled with my family in the U.S. in 2011, finally. I lived here for many years, but Ukraine has always been close to my heart. I had my businesses started there. I have my friends and relatives there, and we had, but at the time when the war started last year, we had a subsidiary, an operation in Ukraine, fully fledged, fully sized up, and delivering e-com solutions for North American merchants, global brands out of Ukraine, including other locations globally that we have. So in my mind, well, first of all, the war did not just start all of a sudden. The origins of it lie in 2014, in that or the revolution that we had, and the people's, you know, basically rise to this level of self-consciousness and understanding that their future lies in the European values, and they're not wanting to go back to the savage rule and then the reality of the Soviet life. In short, for us, it's been an escalation, and I wouldn't say that it was totally unexpected. Yeah, we expected a lot of it. We did not expect it to happen so fast, so harshly, so in your face. So the most important thing was to restore communications with all of our people and making sure that everybody is safe and secure, and to ensure that dealing with the customer issues, yes, it's important. Supporting the customers is important, but the most important thing is actually the life and security and safety of our people and their families. It's a big question how you retain that family culture and closeness and atmosphere as you grow as a company. We were fortunate enough to keep that. We still have that. And so we, after reestablishing the contact with all of them, we started to look for ways to get them out of harm's way, because some of them were in the eastern Ukraine, and Mariupol, that was heavily bombarded.
Uh-huh. Which is now a city that's basically been destroyed. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's incredible. I recall those days, and sitting on the Slack or Zoom call there, and hearing the explosions in the background there, with people just calmly talking about the project, and with the AK-47 and behind the guy, and he's about to go to his territorial defense unit at night to patrol. But he says that, send me some more GR tickets. I do need work because I need to get my mind away from the war all the time. So those are some of the crazy things that I hope to never experience in my life. But the second thing that we did was, so first, the reestablished communications, making sure that they have enough support, and we communicated the logistical routes of everybody through a central command post we had, which was like admin, HR group of people, a couple of people who were coordinating and talking on the mobile phones to everybody. And then I had to establish the governance over client projects and the way that things would be running without my direct involvement here. And I fortunately was able to observe my company in perfect unified operation, cohesively supporting clients uninterrupted service for a month while I was out there. And so I got a ticket and I went to Ukraine. I actually flew into Poland, and I wanted to get into the country to just see myself firsthand what's happening, and also assist the evacuations, including my family, my parents, my in-laws who were there as well. And so, Brian, you wouldn't believe it. At the airport in San Francisco, a person comes to me who heard of me going to Ukraine through Facebook. He gives me an envelope with $20,000, and he says, here's the money for you. You'll put it to good use. I know that you're going to do some humanitarian stuff over there, so use it to good cause. Make sure that we support the troops, we support the people. God bless you. And so with that cash in my pocket and with a lot of hope, I'm going into Warsaw. And my friends and random strangers, they helped me get this cargo van. We fully outfitted to be an ambulance, but before we do that, we fill it up with the meds, with the stock of like blankets and food, and I go in. And nobody knows what to expect, right? So there are a lot of check posts, and the thing that is vivid in my mind from that time is you cross the border into Ukraine, and there are thousands of women and children just walking to get out of the country, walking along the sideway. Amazing. In the rain, in the snow, just having their little pets and their little backpacks, and having no supply whatsoever. Cars are running out of gas, traffic jams all across, and then soldiers meeting them on the Polish side and saying, you're safe now, this is for you, and giving them warm clothes and blankets, and them just staring in disbelief that this is happening to them. I did a couple of shuttle runs into Ukraine, taking the people out and taking those humanitarian supplies in, and then I realized we need to do something on a bigger scale. We need to somehow make it more efficient, and I just cannot do it by myself. And it's not a hero play. Like, there is a better play to be had here. So we started a charity with the help of pro bono lawyers here in San Francisco. God bless them. And we applied for the IRS tax-free status. And instead of a year, which normally it takes for IRS to approve that status, it took them 12 days to approve our status. We started to collect the donations, the funds, and we got in touch with a couple of hospitals in central Ukraine that were dispatch centers for all the supplies for the frontline, treating wounded, triaging all the routes and so forth. And so we started to supply them directly. They would send us the letters of what it is that they need, and we started bringing that in. So my son moved to Warsaw. We moved, I registered the subsidiary in Warsaw. We moved several employees and hired an office in Warsaw, rented it, and we established operations there. And so that was the first initial months. So by the end of the summer last year, we already had collected over $1.1 million in donations, both cash and in kind. A company calls me one day and says, hey, do you need blankets and sheets and pajamas? And I go, well, how much do you have? Well, we'll send you an Excel spreadsheet. And they're sending it, and it's like two C-size containers, you know, $900,000 of stuff that they want us to pick up and just deliver. And God bless them. People, random strangers, would come to you on the side of the road and offer gas and supplies and coffee. And the way that humanity works is unbelievable in these crisis situations. And I only wish that when we're at peace, we would treat each other that way, you know?
Yes.
So I'm probably digressing.
So conditions on the ground.
I'm probably digressing into too many vectors here, but it's very emotional.
No. This is, I hope you don't mind me asking these questions. No, I think they're really important for people to hear. What are conditions like now there?
It's very binary. It's very peaceful in the daytime. It's very life as usual with lilacs and chestnuts blossoming in the city of Kyiv. And sometimes the rockets would fly in the daytime, but then at night, the night is lit with the fireworks, with the anti-aircraft guns and with the rockets exploding. And I just was talking to one of my technical leads who is in Kyiv this morning, and I said, hey, do you have that estimate for you? And he responded to me and said, sorry, I didn't have a chance to look at it for the past two nights. I haven't been sleeping. Those motherfuckers are actually shelling us nonstop. I went there about 3 weeks ago, and a friend of mine who is running local HOA, he showed me that in his apartment building, they have a basement which was organized as a shelter. So it's ready to take in people every night. And sure enough, every other night, they spend it there. They feed the kids. They have the little shop, the little room for communications, recharge, the food preparation station, and so forth. And so people's lives are now like this. You know, we're at war. We're resilient. We're going to win. We're surviving this. We're going to do it together. We're doing the right thing. We have the right cause. Like, there is just no, I never saw so frustration at the level of like giving up and saying that why we need this war, you know, why are we experiencing this? Oh, I don't deserve this. No. We're fighting the savage, evil crime here. And we're going to show them how to live and how to become free, you know?
Yeah, we'll make sure that it's miraaction.org, correct? That people
That's
can...
That's right, miraaction.org. We're called Mira Action. Mira is to look, to aim in Spanish, right? So mira is a great word, like look, mira. So look, we need to act today. That's the meaning of it.
Yeah. So miraaction.org. We'll make sure that's in the show notes as well. And if anyone's interested in supporting the great work your organization is doing, we'd love to encourage that. Yeah. I don't think I'm going to ask, but I'll just bring it up in case you feel like you want to comment. You know, the kind of the end game here, there's a lot of conversations about, you know, a spring offensive and maybe turning the tables. How do you look at that from your vantage point? And if you don't feel like it's appropriate to comment, that's fine.
I'm not a geopolitician and I'm not a strategist, well-versed in politics, but I will tell you that the level of resolve and the level of the motivation and just the general atmosphere amongst Ukrainians worldwide is at the level which I have never seen in my life. I've never read about this in the books. I've never seen such an example of people in unity, standing close together and fighting this war to winning it. And this is not about some political game. This is not about someone's interests, although some people claim that it is. This is about the survival of a nation that is under genocide and that is under the existential threat. And you have to realize that when the opposing enemy is running their war, in their mind, they're freeing us from, us Ukrainians, from the evil Western influence. That we are actually brothers, but you, my brother, just do not understand that we are brothers. You've been fooled by these Westerners and their propaganda, and we need to bring you back into the fold. And once we do, you'll be happy. But for now, we're going to go in there and we're going to do all this, right? So in their minds, it's all about getting back to the United States with the payback for the loss of the cold in the Cold War. In their mind, they wouldn't have gas in their apartments. They wouldn't have toilets. Instead, 70% of the population still uses outhouses today. But in their mind, they would rather survive that and be aggressive and be, we will show those United States what this is all about, right? So motivation on their side is very strange. Motivation on the Ukrainian side is such that, you know, with all the support that we've got so far, Ukrainian army is one of the strongest, if not the strongest army out there. Ukraine is firmly embedded into the European Union as of now, you know, and it's only a matter of time when Ukraine is going to regain its territory, reestablish the borders, and we're going to have to rebuild that country and contribute to its future. Yep. I do believe that is going to be the next example of what can be done when people unite together and build a true democratic, you know, very cohesive state. But how long is going to last? It will last for a long time. I don't think that this is going to be a short offensive and a very quick defeat. The enemy is very strong. It's very large. I think that everybody realizes that. I don't think people are fooling themselves. Unfortunately, there are lots of lives that would be lost. I have friends who are out there on the front lines who are reporting back. And, you know, it's a brutal fight every day. And it's a meat slaughter. It's those things that you see about the Second World War in the Stalingrad battles when, you know, they keep sending people to the machine guns. They keep sending people who are inexperienced, who do not know the art of war, who have not been properly equipped, and they're just sending them to slaughter. And those are 18, 20-year-old boys that are dying for what? You know? So, yeah, we can talk about this for a long time. So, you know, if I was a fortune teller, I'd tell you, but, you know, who knows? Maybe we'll see it end faster, as I hope it will.
Yeah, well, we are all hoping for peace and a return to peaceful coexistence and people focusing on, you know, raising their lives, raising their families and improving their lives and prosperity, peace and joy returning to Ukraine.
And again, I will say this, that we here in these great United States, the country that I love, that has been founded on such fundamental principles of the rule of law and justice, we don't realize how fragile those values are and mm-hmm. those foundations are today and how things can disintegrate with the foreign influence and propaganda overnight, literally overnight. And we always need to remember that we don't have to be human only during the wartime when somebody is wounded next to us and requires to be saved. It's the time to be human is now. So I'm a big proponent of this concept in my field of profession, in my professional area. I call it human commerce. We are building these websites. We're deploying these solutions not to get you a new shiny tool, to get the logo in our portfolio, to bill you with professional services so that we can enrich ourselves. We are supporting the interaction between people that actually drove human civilization for centuries, for thousands of years. Commerce has been the driver of progress.
That's right.
And we are powering commerce today, and we are helping to facilitate this human conversation. And we are humans. You and I, you work on the software side of things. I work on the services side of things. And our merchants are sellers out there. And all three of us, we need to be talking as humans because it's first and foremost about the relationship and the success journey of that hero or fairy, that merchant who is trying to make a living, who is paying taxes, who's creating jobs, and us supporting them in making this happen. So we need always to remember about this human element of things.
Exactly. I couldn't agree more. And if you think about it, I love that point you made because I've often said something similar, right? There's nothing more human than commerce, trading, right? That's the origin of commerce, right? So I have carved this bone into a spearhead. You have a bushel of wheat. Let's make a trade. You know, often, of course, that's a very flowery way to you know, very positive way to frame it. Obviously, there's a lot more to that, but it's very fundamental. And so even as we move that into and use these new tools, use technology to facilitate that and take it global and to reach bigger and bigger audiences, It's fundamentally a human activity, right? And of course, it's foundational to our entire economy and way of life as well. And it's a great, great segue into our last question on the podcast, which we always ask every guest. And before I move on to that last question, though, Sergey, I want to thank you for sharing all of that about the Ukraine, what you personally and your organization have done, and to say, you know, the Ukrainian people have been a tremendous example to me and to everyone about, you know, fighting for what's important and to really getting back to some really fundamental principles about life, liberty, justice, and love. So I want to thank you for that.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Now for our last question. Our last question is, what futuristic digital commerce or innovation are you most looking forward to seeing become a reality? Or alternatively, what innovation do you think is terribly overhyped, simply ridiculous, and we should stop talking about?
Well, I'll start from the end part of this. So we should not stop talking about innovations in any case. And as ridiculous as some concepts may sound, it may become a reality. Maybe the time has not come for it.
Yes.
Okay. But I believe in dreaming and dreaming up solutions. And look, we are lazy as humans. And so we want to make things easier. And so everything that helps us to relieve ourselves of the manual mundane tasks, and we can delegate those to machines so that we can apply our creative powers, right? We should focus on that. Like, you know, a little segue into this. Every time I walk out of the airport, I see those people standing at the exits, making sure that the traffic moves in only one direction, right? And so I call them human photo element jobs. And I can't wait until we actually eradicate those jobs to allow those people to actually be creative humans building something and spending time with their loved ones and not just staring into nothingness, sitting there for the whole day, right? So those are the kinds of things that are still around. And as long as there are jobs like that, we have a big job to do ourselves. So, but back to your question, I think there are a couple of exciting areas that I'm particularly interested in, and they finally are materializing into something tangible. A few years back, I took a course on machine learning 101 online just to get myself back into the math and understand the weeds of things of what's happening, because there's a lot of hype. And so it's interesting that these statistical methods and these machine learning algorithms and neural networks are finally getting to the level where we can have a guided conversation to help us get to the right facts faster and to actually narrow down our selection to help us make informed choices better, right? So I'm talking about this conversational type search. I'm talking about conversational AI support tools that support our activities as humans. So those things are only going to predict what they see from the training models, right? From the training libraries. And those things are going to tell us relevant facts, but they're not going to be creating solutions to problems. So in my mind, there's always going to be that human element that's going to be a necessity in modifying those tools, adjusting the way they work. But I'm interested in AI in search. I'm interested in AI in all things that support the operations of businesses. So the other day, I heard this magnificent application of AI. There is a tool out there that allows you to upload your contract, commercial contract, and it'll analyze the contract for the obvious flaws or gaps or the concepts that are not straightforward and things that are not compliant with the existing legislation and so forth, basically being the lawyer in your pocket. But then the other day, I also heard that one of the lawyers filed a case with the judge in the United States using AI, and that AI actually created fictitious precedents that it referred to in the case, and the lawyer was heavily fined for using AI in that work, right? So that area is, in particular, is very interesting to me. So deploying those tools, interactive, visual, voice, conversational search, dialogue that will help me narrow the choices to the one that I need as a shopper in my space would be interesting. Another one is augmented reality. So I'm not a big believer in VR and actually walking around with this huge VR set and virtual meta type experiences. I think that's the one you can label hype for now. So I don't necessarily want to spend my life walking the virtual space all day around and interacting with other virtual human beings. But AR is changing the way we work, the way we learn, the way we shop, the way we interact with physical. So digital actually enriches physical. So you can add digital components and digital interfaces to the physical objects if you point the camera, which is AR enabled, on them. So think about the machine that tells you what is exactly broken or what filter it needs to be replaced and how to install that filter on it, overimposing that digital twin over the physical object. Or think about walking the store and scanning the shelf with your camera, and for this application to identify products that you're looking for or would be relevant to you based on your preferences. One particular thing would be like wine. You know, wine shelves that are full of wine labels that look beautiful, but you have no idea what they are. And why don't you curate your preferences initially and then have that app tell you that this, and this wine are the ones that you would like?
It could be things like diet, right? Or, for example, my daughter, who's a vegan and is very, very careful about the products that she buys. And so going through the grocery store with her, you know, can take a lot of time because she's going to stop and read every label before she decides to buy it. And that's a great application for something like AR, right? To help her more quickly find the products that she's looking for and that meet her needs, while, you know, I might be looking for, you know, something very different.
But it's all about personalization. So AR is a tool to help you personalize and understand and to educate you to make that informed choice. Again, going back to that concept of human commerce, our job is not to sell you another Nissan, okay? It may be for somebody who is in sales of Nissans, but our job is to help you with that transaction, with that purchase, with that recommendations at the time when you need it, when it's relevant to you, and when it helps you live a better life, when it helps you to actually save time, right? And so my focus this year is on building a prototype of AR platform to further develop that as a concept, where we can shop the shelf, shop the catalog, and actually point the camera at the product and get that product out of the box virtually and see how it fits our space, things like that. And then deploying those conversational voice-enabled searches across the merchant sites of ours. That's very important. People just don't realize how important the intelligent search on the site is. You know, this is fundamental to the search to the site experience today. You search on Google, sure, but once you land on the site, how do you navigate the site? So out-of-the-box search engines really don't cut it today. And I think that there's a lot of disruption that's going to happen in that space in the next 18 to 24 months.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I think the experiences are going to become conversational and contextual, and there'll be a lot of opportunities to make that experience even more efficient and delightful for the customer. And things like AR, which you mentioned, it's another way to present the information in a way that can be very useful, right, for a customer. And yeah, we're not there yet, but I agree with you. There's a reason why it's kind of a slow hunch. We know that it's going to come about. And we also know that all the technology we need to make that happen is essentially already available now. It's about putting it together and making an experience that is transformative. And then everyone says, oh, that's what I want. Just like search is being transformed right now because the experience is so much better, right, than, you know, sorting through 1,000 sponsored links and dead ends on a Google search. So,
I really like how Google put it together at the I/O conference, developer conference the other day. They said it's not going to be any more about the 10 blue links in the search results.
Right. Deserve exactly better. Right.
And I think that there are lots of ways to get more up to speed on all of this and get your mind wrapped around these concepts and actually see the practical applications and use of it. I would strongly advise for anybody who is interested in this use of AI practical use cases to actually take a basic course online, to take a course in machine learning or application of AI, to listen to a couple of YouTube videos on the subject. There are really nice TED Talks that now talk about AI. I think, the one that I wanted to recommend is Yuval Harari, the author of The Homo Sapiens and Homo Deus.
Yes.
Famous philosopher and historian. He just had a talk on AI. It's a 40-minute recording on YouTube that anybody can look up. And he talks about the impact of AI on humanity and how it's going to change our lives across all the different domains. And you listen to that and your mind is blown away by, I haven't even considered that before. How, wow, this is going to change my life tomorrow. And he's been pretty right on his predictions in his book so far about the pandemic and the global warming and various other things that are happening to us right now.
Well, I just took a note for myself as well, because I'm very interested in that. And just to plug a little bit too, we're also hosting an AI summit at Bloomreach in August. And I think it's a great opportunity to get together with other industry leaders and explore what does the application of this technology mean for the customer experience, mean for the operations, mean for the transformation of our business. And that's an ongoing conversation. It's not something we're going to settle now. This is something we're going to be talking about and seeing evolve for decades. But it's a good time for people to, as you said, get educated, you know, be smart about it, understand there's opportunities right now to leverage this. And obviously there's opportunities for the experience to transform dramatically, and potentially how we engage digitally as human beings, but obviously how we conduct commerce could look very different in a relatively short period of time. So I couldn't agree more.
Yeah, I think we live in the exciting time.
Yeah, we do.
You know, people always complain that I wish I lived in that era or this era. I think this is the best time to live in. There's just so much going on, and we can be upping our game and contributing so much more. We don't realize how much we can contribute. So you can consider yourself to be a small drop in the ocean, but that you can also impact millions of people through your daily grit and hard work and doing something right that you believe in. And I just cannot be happier in the space that I'm in, because even though e-commerce as a technology space, you know, solutioning space, platform space, it's pretty small, and people know each other mostly. I think that people here have a true customer focus at heart. And nowhere in the other technology verticals have I seen people who have so much exciting stuff going on right now, you know, as the practical application of technology. So,
what a wonderful sentiment for us to end our conversation on. Thank you for that. Sergey, again, thank you so much for joining us. Fascinating conversation, as I knew it would be. And I want to thank you again for all the work and efforts you've done, both to contribute to our industry and obviously with what's happening in Ukraine. So I want to thank you for both of those things. And I look forward to seeing you in person, hopefully in the not too distant future again as well. So thank you.
Thank you as well for your hard work and for making this happen. And I know that we will have a lot of interesting conversations going forward. We'll support a lot of merchant journeys together.
Yes, indeed. All right. To you, Sergey, as well as the everyone tuning in and listening here today, please be safe, be well, and here's to good business.
Never stop.